You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth. Hey!
Spanning the globe to bring you the latest developments in medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja.
We love the herb.
It's time for the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville. Now, here's your host, Russ Belville.
Good day, tokers and tokettes and non-toking lovers of liberty. It is Wednesday, June 28th, 2017, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. Thanks for joining us here in the middle of the week on the Marijuana Agenda, where we've got all sorts of new things happening. Our cannabis headline news, free 5-minute news podcast, is now available at its own website, news.mjagenda.com, and you can get your free subscription link there for all the platforms: Facebook, Google, iTunes, iHeartRadio, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Just check out news.mjagenda.com and follow CB Headline News on Twitter. We now have a Twitter account, and every story that I cover here on the Marijuana Agenda, I'll tweet out the link to that story on CB Headline News. On our show today in the Cannabis Minority Report, we have exclusive video from our activist correspondent, Wayne Reese. He filmed Reverend Al Sharpton delivering a keynote address at CWCBE in New York. We got that right after the news. In drug war data mining, an extended segment with Amanda Ryman, who brings us a new study on opioid replacement by using medical marijuana. In our Northwest Cannabis Chronicle, we hear from an Oregon regulatory experts panel from the Oregon Marijuana Business Conference. And in hour two in the Radical Rant, I'll tell you how the worst of us are going to ruin legalization for the rest of us.
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
Looking for the 420 friendliest way to visit beautiful legal Potland, Oregon?
I'm Lori Duckworth, inviting you to come stay with us at Delta 9 House and Studios.
You get your own private room with queen bed and access to our high-speed Wi-Fi, premium entertainment system, and more.
We'll even cook you breakfast. Look us up on Facebook at Delta 9 House.
That's facebook.com/Delta9House.
Delta 9 House is booked through Airbnb.com, City of Portland, permit number 17-159855.
The Marijuana Agenda, like the alcohol agenda. But a lot safer.
Hi, I'm Russ Belville from The Marijuana Agenda. Putting together the most comprehensive live weekday marijuana news talk program is a full-time job. Now you can do your part to ensure that listener-supported independent cannabis radio journalism can continue by becoming a patron of the Marijuana Agenda. Just log on to mjagenda.com and click the Become a Patron button. For your $4.20 monthly donation, you'll receive over 20 hours of original first-hour podcasts, plus other materials only available to paid subscribers. Or for just $9.99 a month, become a VIP patron. You'll get over 40 hours of podcasts for the complete program, including Toker Talk Radio, plus ad-free downloads of the segments heard on the Marijuana Agenda. Plus, VIPs get exclusive access to the video replay of the two-hour live stream show and downloads of the spreadsheets and charts I provide from my years of curating marijuana data sets. Thank you for your support, and remember, I cannot do it without you. Please become a patron today at mjagenda.com.
This is your Cannabis Headline News, brought to you by MarijuanaMoment.net, the complete source for all your marijuana news in one morning newsletter from Marijuana Majority founder Tom Angel. Subscribe today for free at MarijuanaMoment.net.
This is your Cannabis Headline News for Wednesday, June 28th, 2017. I'm Russ Belville. In a joint United Nations statement on ending discrimination in healthcare settings released today, the World Health Organization and the United Nations called for reviewing and repealing punitive laws that have been proven to have negative health outcomes and that counter established public health evidence. These include laws that criminalize or otherwise prohibit gender expression, same-sex conduct, adultery and other sexual behaviors between consenting adults, adult consensual sex work,
drug use or possession of drugs for personal use, sexual and reproductive health care services, including information, and overly broad criminalization of HIV non-disclosure, exposure, or transmission. Despite increasing threats to enforce federal marijuana prohibition from U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, MassRoot's Tom Angel reports that a fellow member of the Trump administration's cabinet just used the podium in the White House press briefing room to advocate for states' rights to set their own cannabis laws. Quote, "I thought that Colorado was wrong in allowing for the use of marijuana, which they've decided to do. But that's their call," Energy Secretary Rick Perry said on Tuesday, continuing, "I will defend that right robustly. That ought to be their call," end quote. Perry, a former Texas governor, was answering a question about the Clean Power Plan, an Obama-era energy policy that requires individual states to meet specific standards on reducing carbon dioxide emissions, and which the Trump administration is considering scrapping, criticizing, quote, "this idea that we're going to have one size fits all out of Washington, D.C., Perry said. "One of the reasons I came to serve with President Trump was because I knew he believed in that," end quote. California Governor Jerry Brown on Tuesday signed a $183 billion state budget the veteran Democrat touted as an example of the state's fiscal prudence among, quote, "uncertain times," end quote. The Sacramento Bee reports that the deal agreed to by Brown as part of a budget-related bill blends Proposition 64 and medical marijuana laws previously approved by the legislature. Highlights include a $100 infraction for driving with an open container of weed and continues to allow local communities to ban marijuana deliveries in their jurisdictions. Asked by Fox 13 Salt Lake City about the medical marijuana ballot initiative filed in Utah, a spokesman for the Mormon Church responded with a statement rejecting it. Quote, "We believe that society is best served," reads the statement, "by requiring marijuana to go through further research and the FDA approval process that all other drugs must go through before they are prescribed to patients," end quote. According to a poll released Monday by Fairbank, Maslin, Mullen, Metz, and Associates, 73% of Utahns back a proposed statewide ballot measure to, quote, "allow doctors to recommend medical marijuana as a treatment for cancer, epilepsy, Alzheimer's, and other serious illnesses," end quote. The intensity of the support for the proposed measure is just as impressive as its breadth. In fact, nearly half of all Utah voters, 49%, indicate that they would definitely vote in favor of the measure. Just one in five, 20%, are opposed. Oregon Public Broadcasting reports that as many as 20,000 people are converging on a meadow in the Malheur National Forest in Oregon's Grant County this week for the Rainbow Gathering. The annual event attracts hippies and travelers from around the country, but a small team of federal prosecutors and judges will also be there. The U.S. Forest Service is working with federal judges from the District of Oregon and assistant prosecutors with the U.S. Attorney's Office to set up a temporary court in Grant County that can handle federal citations during the gathering. The remote court will be able to handle everything from simple parking violations to drug offenses and minor assaults. It's not clear to what extent federal prosecutors will charge people who use marijuana during the gathering, however. Oregon voted to legalize in 2014, and preventing marijuana use on federal property is one of the government's stated enforcement priorities. KPR News producer Casey Morrill reports on Twitter that Nevada State Senator Tick Siegerblum, a recent guest on this program and a longtime advocate for reforming marijuana laws, quote, "will be the first recreational cannabis customer at Reef Dispensaries 12 a.m. on July 1st, end quote.
You're listening to The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
At Herbie's Cannabis Seeds, we pride ourselves on bringing you the best quality seeds from the world's most respected cannabis seed producers, all at the lowest online prices. You can find Herbie's Seeds at herbiesheadshop.com. All cannabis seeds are sold as souvenirs and as a means of preserving cannabis genetics. Herbie's Seeds in no way intends to condone, promote, or incite the use of illegal or controlled substances. We strongly urge all prospective customers to check their national laws prior to placing an order. Herbie's Seeds at herbiesheadshop.com. Proud sponsors of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
The Marijuana Agenda, like the pharmaceutical agenda, without all the side effects, overdose deaths, you know, insurance.
Side effects may include nausea, dry mouth, and constipation. Dry mouth, constipation, indigestion, and abdominal pain.
Which can occur without warning and may cause death.
If you work in the cannabis industry, consume marijuana, or just support freedom, you need to know about breaking policy news that affects you. Marijuana Moment is the daily newsletter that helps you stay on top of all the latest and most important state, federal, and international cannabis developments. Brought to you by longtime legalization activist Tom Angel, Marijuana Moment puts a concise yet comprehensive overview of cannabis news in your inbox early every weekday morning. Wake up to Marijuana Moment and rest assured you'll be ready for the cannabis news that's driving the day. Subscribe now at marijuanamoment.net.
This is the Cannabis Minority Report. The war on drugs has been called the new Jim Crow, for how it disproportionately polices and incarcerates people of color. As marijuana legalization proceeds, institutional barriers still prevent minorities from fully participating in the new industry. Today, we take a deeper look at these issues in the Cannabis Minority Report.
Today on the Cannabis Minority Report, we turn to our activist correspondent Wayne Reese, who filmed the Reverend Al Sharpton delivering the keynote address at the Cannabis World Congress and Business Expo in New York City.
My name is Scott Giannotti. It's an honor and a privilege to have all of you here today. First, I'd like to introduce a friend and colleague, Mr. Lamont Bland. He's the founder of L.D. Bland & Associates. In 2014, he sought to merge his experience in politics, law, community organizing, advocacy, civil rights, and social justice. Upon learning of his daughter's diagnosis of polymicrogyria, Attorney Bland began researching various ways, including medical cannabis, that would allow people, including children like his daughter, to live independently. I'd like to bring up Lamont Bland. He's going to say a few words. Thank you all.
How are you all doing today? Thank you all for coming out for these very important issues and to hear from a dynamic speaker who has been known to push issues of social justice and civil rights in this country. Again, my name is Lamont Bland. In 2015, my daughter was born, and 7 months later, I was told that my daughter had developed a brain disorder that would enable her to, in some instances, not possibly be able to walk, and she would suffer from epileptic seizures. So I put my law practice on side, like any other parent would do, and started focusing on ways to make sure my daughter could live a normal life, just like everyone else would do. And I went around the country listening to people in the business trying to find alternatives for persons that are living with those types of disorders. And to my surprise, I realized that there was an issue with access to drugs, and also an issue with the cost of drugs, because the insurance carriers were not paying, allowing bills to be deducted for the cost of the medicine. And then talking to others, we started hearing about issues of decriminalization in the industry, whereas persons who had criminal records were not able to get into the cannabis business. And you also heard about Attorney General Sessions instituting regulations that would put low, nonviolent drug offenders in the prison system. Then we started hearing about women and minority-owned businesses that were not getting opportunities and access in the industry, and businesses that cannot put their money in banks to reinvest in communities, and the tax code that were making it difficult for businesses to reinvest in workers through training because the tax code would not allow for deductions for workers. And I got on the phone and I called Bill Lynch, whose father was a national organizer and a political strategist. And Bill took over the firm and he said, "It sounds like you have a coalition here." He said, "It's a coalition of people that want to see this industry do well. And now you need to figure out how to find someone they can mobilize everyone." And we were scratching our heads, but not for long. And we knew that we needed to call on somebody we knew that is organizing this country from the grass tops to the grassroots, that takes on issues of civil rights and social justice and does not back down in the fight. And my heart told me to reach out to Reverend Al. And I seen him in the trenches, and I knew that if he was staying with this industry, I could benefit because I see my daughter getting access to drugs that she'll need, and others like her. And I see business owners getting opportunities, and I see the industry growing to what it is, which is a thriving industry that is pushing and moving drugs that benefit people. You know, the scientific proof that these drugs are benefiting the community. And I thought that it was important to talk to him because we're dealing with decriminalization and inclusion and making sure there's proper access. But I don't want to hold you all any longer. Thank you all for being here. But at this time, I would like to call to the stage Reverend Al Sharp.
Thank you, Attorney Bland. And at this event, saying I organize from grassroots to grass tops has a different connotation. When Attorney Lamon Bland brought this issue to Mass Action Network and I, and when I looked at the statements made by Attorney General Sessions of criminalizing medical marijuana and those in communities that have already disproportionately suffered, I said to Bill Lynch Jr. and to him that not only would we come and support the efforts of decriminalization and to protect the rights of people that need this medical treatment, but that we would do it right at the expo, because I do not believe in throwing a rock and hiding your hand. I wanted to be here with you to say this and to challenge us to have a movement around issues, but have it with those that understand it from all levels. I spent time with the Drug Policy Alliance, who have been gathering, some of them are here, stand up, give them a hand. They have been in the vineyard for a long time dealing with this issue, and they have done the work and should be at the forefront and leadership of a national movement around this. Why? Because it is a civil rights issue as much as it is an industry issue. And sometimes movements are those that gather motivated by different things in its inception, but none of the members of the groups can benefit unless all benefit. We look at the Drug Policy Alliance and Mass Action Network as a civil rights and human rights and decriminalization issue. And it has been put into legislative form by Senator Kruger here in the state of New York and my longtime friend and co-freedom fighter, Assemblywoman Crystal Peoples. And they have a bill in New York State that we support 100% and will be campaigning for its passage. And I think that we owe it to them to stand forthright on the Senate bill and the Assembly bill. Yeah. A reporter asked me, why would I come and support the decriminalization? Do I smoke weed? That's always the question. Well, over a decade ago, I came out in support of same-sex marriage, and I'm not gay. I come today to say that we must decriminalize what they're doing in this industry. I don't smoke weed, but those that have the medical need need to be able to fulfill that. And we are tired of seeing young people, disproportionately black and Latino, go to jail for weed and small amounts while the corporate that broke the economy walk away unscathed with no criminal indictment or prosecution. Why do I support it? For years in New York, look at the combined New York black and Latino population. We account for a little more than a third of the population. Yet 85% of the people arrested annually on marijuana possession are black and Latino. Why do I support it? Marijuana prohibition has almost entirely been enforced in communities of color. Why do I support it? Because possession of marijuana is at the top of the misdemeanor arrest in the state of New York. When you look at the fact, though, a lot of people do not understand that there are consequences that are almost unthinkable. There are consequences to housing. You can lose your residence in city housing if you have a marijuana conviction. You can be held and detained with immigration if you have a marijuana conviction. You can be denied employment if you have a marijuana conviction. You can be refused for schools or certain admission to certain colleges with a marijuana conviction. This is just about something that does not overlap into other areas of our society, and it disproportionately impacts people of color. So as we have this gathering today, I will challenge the civil rights community as a whole that we cannot talk about civil rights and we cannot talk about fair housing and fair immigration and opening up the schools, the higher places of higher education, without discussing the criminalization of marijuana and marijuana use in this country. For the Attorney General to declare that he is going after an industry that some people have medical needs for the Attorney General to stand now in the way of a movement that over 23 states has already legalized, I know that that will lead to a disproportionate amount of people in my community that will be going to jail, that will be subject to police harassment, that will be subject to other areas that we will, on the backside, want to fight when we need to cut it off on the front side. And that is why this is important. Same reason why last year we did a national tour on the what are the impacts, the unintended consequences of banning certain brands in tobacco. I don't smoke Kohl's or Newports, but I don't want to see police states where you got, like in Oakland, a consent decree and they want to ban just menthol. They don't want to ban Lucky Strikes. So guys wearing Texas hats can smoke theirs, but our kids are going to a black market if we have to deal with this. The unintended consequences that they're using and putting it around the cult of morality is something that we must speak in a forthright manner. But let me also challenge the industry, that the industry must be inclusive of blacks and Latinos and people of color participating. We can, on one side, have the disproportionate punishment, and on the other side, have a disproportionate lack of involvement and business opportunities in this industry. This industry last year went up to $7 billion, yet less than 1% have black dispensaries that are owned and operated. We must raise to the level of activism in the industry, but we must also rise ownership and management and participation on the business side. Yes. We don't need to be locked up by law enforcement and locked out by the industry.
Yes.
We also do not need those that will appoint themselves to speak on these issues and sidestep those like the Drug Policy Alliance that have been in this for years, taking the brunt of the law enforcement community, of those reactionary forces, and even some in their own community. People that will lead the fight in New York, that Nash Action Network will back, people that will lead the fight around this country are groups like the Drug Policy Alliance that have been there all along, not some new well-funded people that think they will parachute in and speak for us that never spoke to us. So my challenge to you is that as we deal with the legislation that is exampled in New York by Ms. Kruger and Ms. Peoples, that we will rally around that. But we want to see in that there is an inclusive policy to make sure that people do not have unrealistic goals that has to be established or requirements to be able to come into business. Well, Reverend, we've got those requirements. They had them in the South to stop us from voting.
Yeah, tell it.
They don't say blacks couldn't vote. They'd say, just tell us how many jelly beans are in the jar.
Right.
Just tell me how to say the alphabet backwards and forward and give it to me in Spanish. They come with requirements that they know we can't meet to require people that have no kind of record, even minor offenses, to have other impediments is designed to lock people out while we try to lift up the legitimate issue that will benefit all of you that are at this expo. So my message to you is that we must take on those that will try to shut the industry down, but we must also take on those in the industry that want to shut folks out. This must be a people's movement. We cannot say to our young people that you should have the right with the medical marijuana that based on your needs to have a joint, but you can't never own the joint.
Mm.
That's a sound bite.
No, good point.
I would hope that we understand in the 21st century, just months after President Barack Obama commuted the sentences of more low-level non-violent drug offenders than the last 11 presidents combined, that we do not take lightly that the new Attorney General has said he's not only going to reverse that, but is going to try to start locking people up again. This is a call to action for all of us to stand against reactionary criminal justice policies, reactionary policies against those in medical need, reactionary policies against those that will disproportionately suffer in communities of color, and we must deal with those reactionary forces in the industry that want to use it as a private club to become oligarchs rather than to be open to let us liberate people that need it, that have been denied it because of archaic laws that in many ways cut off people in need, like Attorney Bland's son. I think that it is something we're committed to. I didn't want to send a statement. I wanted to come and make my statement. I hope that we will move out together to deal internally and externally with this industry.
This episode was produced as part of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville, the daily news and interview podcast covering the world of medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. MJAgenda.com. You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
New beginner guitars and banjos are often constructed much better than ones built before your time. Why struggle? Get a new instrument or fix the old one. The trusted professionals at the Fingerboard Extension will evaluate your instrument for free. Repairs are priced for people who work for a living. Stop by the Fingerboard Extension downtown Corvallis at 120 Northwest 2nd Street today, or check out its inventory on the web at fingerboardextension.com.
Promoting the end of adult cannabis prohibition is easy because we have facts, science, reason, compassion, evidence, truth, and logic on our side. It's even easier when researchers catalog it all for us. Learn how to gather the facts on marijuana use, arrests, seizures, rehabs, drug tests, and more on this edition of Drug War Data Mining.
Welcome to another edition of Drug War Data Mining. I'm Russ Belville, and joining me by telephone from Mendocino County, we have a good friend of the show, Dr. Amanda Ryman, formerly with the Drug Policy Alliance, and now apparently living large in the Emerald Triangle. Dr. Ryman, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic, Russ. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I was excited to get you on because of this new study you're a part of. The press release I got says UC Berkeley and HelloMD released study on cannabis use as a substitute for opioid and non-opioid-based pain medication. And boy, this couldn't be better timed with everyone now becoming more aware of the overdose epidemic in America and how we're on pace to have more people die this year from drug overdose than died in the entire Vietnam War. So give us a little of the background on what led you to make this survey, do this study, and what is it telling us?
Sure. So, you know, substitution of cannabis for other substances, more harmful substances, was really pioneered by Dr. Todd Micaria in the 1970s, who was a prominent psychiatrist in San Francisco and really one of the pioneers in the modern medical cannabis movement. And he found that when his patients who had issues with alcohol and other substances used cannabis, they had much better outcomes in terms of a whole host of variables in their life. So when I did my dissertation research in 2005, I included a question about substitution largely because of Dr. Micaria's work and the work of Dr. Frank Lucido in Berkeley. And what I found in that research study was that a great number of patients were saying, yes, I am using cannabis consciously as a substitute for a substance that I deem to be more harmful to me in my life. And that was really interesting to me at the time because a lot of folks thought about people using cannabis as a last resort, right? It's like, I've tried everything else, nothing works, I'll go to cannabis. But these folks were actually saying, no, I'm making the choice to use cannabis as a first line of defense because I don't like the outcomes when I use other prescription medications or other substances like alcohol. So I did a study in 2009 of 350 patients and found, again, very high rates of substitution, especially for prescription drugs, and especially for reasons such as less withdrawal potential with cannabis, less negative side effects and chance of dependence with cannabis. So this study was replicated several times up in Canada, and we found the same results. So we were thinking, yes, patients are using cannabis as a substitute. The interest in opiates really came from what you're speaking of, which is a huge rise in the number of people who are having problematic experiences with opioid-based medications. And while there are a lot of people that benefit from these medications, the safety profile compared to cannabis is such that it's really unbelievable that we are using opioids as a first line of defense while still demonizing people for using cannabis. So, of course, one of the big barriers to studying this is the lack of access to cannabis for clinical research purposes. So where we're still at with this is primarily patient self-report, which is what this study that I conducted was. However, if you get enough people who report the same thing, there really starts to be a robust understanding that this is a phenomenon that is happening and that is something that patients report. So HelloMD has a very large database of medical cannabis patients in California, and so we felt a good next step would be to try to collect a very large sample of patients so that we could say that this is more than just a fluke, this is more than just anecdotal, and really provide support for going a step further, which is actually looking at a clinical controlled environment with which to test this hypothesis.
Is that going to be possible under the Prop 64 that was passed in California? Is there any language or dedicated funds for research such as that?
Absolutely. So there's $4 million a year that's allocated for the Center for Medical Cannabis Research, which is at UC San Diego, that's headed by Igor Grant, who is an amazing scientist. This center was previously funded under prior legislation in California, but once that money ran out, the center really remained dormant. Something interesting that's going to happen, though, is not only is this center going to receive funding, but they're also going to apply to NIDA to be a licensed producer of cannabis for research purposes. You may remember that last year NIDA announced that they were lifting the monopoly on access to NIDA-approved cannabis for research. Right now, it's just the University of Mississippi, but they're saying, hey, if another university or research body can prove that they can grow cannabis for research purposes and it's not going to be diverted, then we would consider granting them a license. And so California, the UC system, is hopefully going to receive one of those licenses. Coupled with the new stream of funding, I'm very hopeful that we'll be able to explore this further.
It's very fascinating research, and I like how this study also dovetails nicely with studies we've been hearing about where states with medical cannabis access have lower rates of opiate prescriptions, opiate overdose, opiate use, opiate abuse and rehab. Talk about that a little bit as far as how you see your data fitting in with what we were finding in these other studies.
Sure. Well, a big part of substitution is choice. So folks can have substitution effects when they have the choice between two substances to treat the same condition. So what we find in medical cannabis states, as from the data that you mentioned, looking at fewer opioid-related fatalities, looking at fewer people checking into treatment for opiate-related issues, looking at fewer prescriptions being written for opiate-based pain medications, we are seeing these in places where we have medical cannabis laws, meaning that people have a choice. And so I think the way that our data fit into this is that we're asking people who do have that choice, who do live in a place like California, where they have the option of using cannabis or they have the option of using opioids, we're asking people who are using both of them, which is working better for you? And they are overwhelmingly saying that the cannabis is working better for them. So, you know, just to give you some idea of the results, we asked patients, you know, kind of on a Likert scale from strongly disagree to strongly agree how cannabis and opiates were working for them regarding the conditions that they were treating. And 97% of the sample strongly agreed or agreed that they could decrease their opioid use when using cannabis. Meaning that they're saying when I am using cannabis and opioids, I can use less opioids, and that is extremely important when we're talking about trying to prevent accidental overdose and when we're trying to prevent dependence. 92% of samples strongly agreed or agreed that they prefer cannabis to treat their medical condition. So when folks are given a choice, they're saying that cannabis is their preference, and that's something that we've seen from multiple other studies. And then finally, slightly less strong but still there, 81% strongly agreed or agreed that cannabis by itself was more effective than taking cannabis with opioids. So they were saying that actually when I just use cannabis, it's more effective than when opioids are added to the mix. And again, you know, given the safety profile of the two substances, this is where I'm really hoping that the medical community will become more open to considering cannabis. I mean, they need to listen to what their patients are telling them. And their patients are telling them that they see opioids as a high-risk substance, that they see cannabis as less risky, and rightfully so, that they're having better outcomes, that they're able to reduce their use of opioids, and that actually cannabis, in many cases, is providing better relief. The idea that we are still pushing opioids on people when cannabis is a viable substitute is almost criminal in a way.
Well put. And I think we should clarify, this isn't about demonizing opiates or the people that are going to need those. It's more about prioritization. Let's make cannabis the medicine of first resort, and then for the people with the severe, severe pain that is not going to respond to cannabis alone, then we've got opiates, but fewer of them. Is that a fair characterization?
Absolutely. And I would say not only fewer of them, but a smaller dose farther apart. And, you know, if you ask me my opinion, which you are, you know, I think that what the best utility here is not necessarily a one-to-one substitution, either or, cannabis for opiates. I do think that people who have a family history of drug dependence, or maybe themselves have had issues with substance dependence, then cannabis should absolutely be the first choice beyond opiates. But I think where the utility really comes in is when you have individuals like you're describing who do require opiates, who have severe pain conditions where opiates are the most effective treatment. But if you use cannabis as well, then we can have those individuals use less opiates further apart, which again is going to impact their chance of accidental overdose or dependence. Because when we talk about these 91 deaths of opiate overdose a day in the United States, these are not individuals that are just trying to get really high. These are not individuals that are trying to commit suicide. These are individuals who are accidentally taking too many opiates too close together, maybe with alcohol, maybe with other medications. So anything that we can do to still allow people to get the relief they need from opioids, but at the same time have them use less of that medication and have them be able to go further between doses, that is pure harm reduction.
Also, I think it's important to note this isn't a simple black and white binary type of issue, that there's a lot of nuance involved here, because obviously getting to 91 opiate-related overdoses a day and the rate at which this has increased can't solely be blamed on people having a lack of access to cannabis, especially if you're considering people overdosing on heroin are going to the same illegal market where they might have to get cannabis. So on a broader perspective, what do you see as solutions to this problem we have of so many people dying from drug overdose?
Well, we have to be more honest and upfront in talking about it. You know, we still treat drug dependence and drug use as this very underground, hush-hush activity, even though it's so commonplace that most Americans engage in it on a daily basis. So I think we need to get real about what actually reduces the number of overdoses and what actually reduces the negative outcomes associated with different modes of drug consumption. So I'm talking about things like safe injection facilities. I'm talking about things like prescription heroin programs. I'm talking about things like Narcan and naloxone being available over the counter. I'm talking about things like more progressive and open minds around substitution therapies and medication-assisted treatment like methadone and cannabis to help people get through withdrawals. And I'm talking about the federal government not passing a health care bill that will severely limit access to services for people who have opioid-related issues. So until we start looking at this from a harm reduction public health perspective and not a criminal justice denialist perspective, we're going to continue to see this problem grow. And unfortunately, in many cases where we see these problems related to opioid overdoses and overprescribing reaching their peak, they're poor rural white areas in the United States where people are self-medicating for more than physical pain. They're self-medicating for poverty, they're self-medicating for powerlessness, and there are plenty of doctors willing to write those prescriptions. So until we start looking at the pharmaceutical company for what it really is, which is no different than the liquor store on the corner in a primarily black neighborhood where we talk about the victimization of those individuals, the pharmaceutical companies are doing the exact same thing to poor white folks in America right now. So we need to stop with this arbitrary line between legal and illegal, safe and unsafe, safe medical doctor and drug dealer, and we need to really start looking what's causing the most harm, and that's these prescription drugs.
Dr. Amanda Ryman is a former lecturer at the School of Social Welfare at UC Berkeley, and of course I met her with her work at Drug Policy Alliance, where you've influenced and impressed me many, many times. Thank you so much for joining us and talking about this new study. Is there a website or some contact information people should know if they want to learn more?
Well, the press release has the study. It's an open access journal, so anyone can access the study. So I don't have the exact link, but if you Google cannabis substitution and my last name in 2017, then it should come up.
All right. And I'll put a link up in our post at the Marijuana Agenda as well. Amanda, thanks so much, and have yourself a great day there in Northern California.
Thank you so much, Russ.
This episode was produced as part of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville, the daily news and interview podcast covering the world of medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. MJAgenda.com.
It's Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda, inviting you to be like me and get your ink done at Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo, Fort Worth's most female-friendly, clean, sterile, awesome tattoo shop. Thomas and his crew are true artists who can design you a custom piece or use a design you bring in. Lucky Horseshoe also offers all styles of tattooing as well as piercings and all-around fun. In the DFW area, stop by Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo and tell them Radical Russ sent you. Trust me, it'll feel awesome.
You're not high. You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
I'm astonished to hear people suggest we can solve our heroin crisis. Have you heard this? By having more marijuana.
Okay, maybe you're a little high. Welcome to the Northwest Cannabis Chronicle, brought to you by the Marijuana Business Association at MJBA.net, the fastest growing cannabis business alliance in America. Today, we catch you up on the latest news and speak with an expert from Cascadia Bioregion of the Pacific Northwest, consisting of the legal marijuana states of Oregon, Washington, and Alaska. Fill your coffee and grab an umbrella. It's time for the Northwest Cannabis Chronicle.
2016 was just a crazy whirlwind of a year. I think, as everyone knows, you know, when we were asked to put projections on how many businesses would want marijuana licenses, and it was basically a guessing game. We were able to take some info from Washington and Colorado and gave it our best shot, estimated between 800 and 1,200 businesses would want to be licensed in the first year, and we were clearly dead wrong. We had over 2,000 by the end of the year, close to 2,500, and it continues to grow. Every week we're getting 50 to or more new applications every week. It was an interesting challenge the first year, given our staffing levels. It was probably one of the biggest struggles that we had. The legislature essentially gave us a total of 14 staff statewide to do all licensing and all compliance work, and that was clearly not enough to handle it. So what we did is we took kind of an all-hands-on-deck approach. We had liquor staff helping with the license applications. We had directors, policy analysts. Amanda and I had our own caseloads, trying to get as many people into business as we could. And we also were facing some significant deadlines that we were up against, you know, the end of early start in October, or wanting to get some business retail businesses online by October 1, and then the end of early start at the end of the year. So it was definitely a long, interesting year as we put together the program essentially from scratch.
How are you guys balancing what licenses are being sought after? I mean, so you got your grows in, I saw a real push, and I got to tell you, working with these people, they have a tiny staff. I mean, there is agencies compared to what OHA had and did basically nothing for us in the last 18 years of the program, to see what a few people at OLCC have really pulled together. And like she said, the folks from the liquor side came in that knew nothing about cannabis and are trying to get these places licenses. They're going all over the state, going to listening sessions. A lot of you probably went to some of the listening sessions that they did early on in the license, you know, before we started licensing, just so people could give some input and on what we wanted in the industry. And they've been really good about kind of finding the middle ground. So how do you how are you balancing now what licenses you're pushing forward versus, so you probably, you know, from what I understand, we've laid off farms a little bit and started getting into retail, and we've done some of that, and now processing. And so what's that look like as far as who's getting, you know, what licenses you're looking at now versus give people kind of a timeline on what they're looking at?
So throughout last year, and what we decided to do from the beginning was license through the supply chain. And, you know, the market needed to get up and running, and so it made sense to focus pretty much exclusively on the growers to start with, then move into the processors, processors and wholesalers, and then finally with the retail at the end of the year, and then labs throughout. Now that we have a year's worth of licenses issued and the market's getting established, we're taking a different approach. We're really just going to be processing license applications based on age. So we're taking the oldest applications first that have an approved LUX submitted with them, and then just working through it regardless of the license type.
So on those licenses, the ones that you've seen and the ones that are licensed now, what are we looking at for renewal status? How are you going to deal with the renewals when you've got such a great load on the new stuff? What's the plan at OLCC to take care of renewals and get that done in a timely manner?
It is definitely going to be a challenge, and it's another one of the reasons we've asked for a significant number of new staff to handle it, because we will need to get everybody that was licensed last year renewed again. One of the positive things about our renewal process is that once you are licensed and you submit a renewal application, you can continue to operate. And so even if it takes us a while to get through the renewal application, it doesn't slow down. The business can continue to operate.
One license that everybody who is already licensed within the OLCC has to get for their employees now is that marijuana handler's card, mm-hmm. which should totally be called a cannabis handler's card. We're interested to find out what the timeline is to get those, since we have to wait for our employees to have the physical card before they can handle any product. So what's the timeline for that, and how can we push that along faster?
Yeah, that's a great question, and probably a lot of people got the bulletin that we sent out a couple weeks ago that said all employees needed to be entered into Metric with their worker permit number by April 1st. This is really quick, and I believe we have, I think, around 8.5, if not 9,000 cards that have already been issued.
We actually have a little over 10,000 as of this morning, and another 5,000 that have been approved. They just haven't paid the license.
10,000 new employees in Oregon. Christy, why don't you tell us a little bit on the legal side, some of the licensing challenges that you've seen. What do people need, like if you're buying or leasing a property, something to that effect, before you get to them, what do licensees need to do that you see the most challenging for them, you know, moving forward before you put in the license?
Sure. Excellent question. I usually tell our clients that, you know, the OLCC documents are probably the most I'll say the scariest in some ways, but they're actually very straightforward. The OLCC does a really good job of making things very clear, not only in the rules for us and for our clients who read them, which, by the way, I'd say about 50% of our clients read the rules, which all of my friends are attorneys, and not one of their clients has ever read a rule about anything, by the way. But I always tell our clients that the OLCC forms might be daunting at first, but what's really the more important thing to look at first is local regulations. That plays into right. Where you buy, where you lease, because problems that come up with the OLCC are usually things that are already anticipated, are not a surprise, and are things that the OLCC can and will work with you to help, you know, fix. What problems you run in at the local levels tend to be things that you might not be able to fix, or it becomes cost prohibitive to try and fix it. So, for instance, you find a property that is zoned properly, and the OLCC looks as though it's going to be perfectly fine with it, but it turns out Jackson County wants that greenhouse you built to be 50 feet a little farther away from the property line, or it's a few thousand square feet larger than you're supposed to have, or you built too close to a wetland or a river, and now your $50,000, $100,000 building is out of compliance, and you'll either be fined for it, or it could be something up to and including you are deemed non-compliant, and you are completely out of sync with state regulations, which means you're unprotected for both local, state, and of course federal regulations as well. So I think the most important thing I tell clients is not only the normal business sense of know who you're getting into business with, whether they're competent, what they say they are, that they're trustworthy, that they don't have anything in their criminal history that could be a precluding factor for your license. I would say that the land you choose and how you choose to develop it is where you need to be the most cautious, because that's where the biggest scale and biggest cost errors occur.
With experience working with OHA and their tracking system and working with Metric, Metric is a godsend. It's amazing. It's helped streamline our intake process, and we've worked really hard with our producers to work with them to figure out the system, because it is a challenge coming out of a completely unregulated system into one that is heavily regulated. The key points that we focus on when entering in metric is, first of all, making sure that every package that comes in, the tag matches not only the package that we have, it matches the metric system's online tag, and then also matches the manifest tag. So you actually have three different documents, well, two documents and the product that you have to look at. Make sure that all of those are correct, because we have had people come in and the package that they give us is not the same package that they have on the manifest. So that will put you out of compliance. We always double check the weight on the packages when they bring in anything that's sealed. You know, unseal it, check it out. If it is a couple grams off, we deny the package and they have to re-manifest us a new one so that we have the correct amount, because they're checking us by the gram, you know, exact amounts. So you have to be very accurate in what you're accepting into your store. And then you have to carry that metric tag on the product in your store until you do not have the product anymore, and then you must destroy that. It's been really great to have this system, because in the past, our intake has taken probably 50% more time than it takes now to get in a package. And the first month was a little difficult getting people through the process, but I have to say now people come in and our intake takes like 10 minutes now instead of 30 minutes. So it's been really great. People who are a little apprehensive about it, just give it a chance. And once you figure it out, I think you'll end up loving it. The OHA's other proposed tracking system was really time-consuming and not as streamlined as metric is.
There's some farmers in here that may want to know, how do these farmers that have never gone out and solicited a store, how do they approach you with products that they have come in, and what's the proper way? They make an appointment with you, they come in. Can you just briefly kind of explain what they should do to get their product in front of you?
Well, the first thing I recommend is finding out where you want to take your product and what is their procedure for intake. At the greener side, you call, we'll schedule an appointment for you. You come in on your appointment, you bring your product, you bring your manifest. If you don't manifest over your product and you bring in samples, we will deny you. So find out that procedure, manifest stuff over. We come in, we'll take a look at your product, and at that point, we'll either accept it or not accept it. One huge thing for us as a company is to always give everyone a chance. We have had some amazing growers come in and had a product that they told me when they went to another store, the person laughed at them. So they brought it to us. We took that product. We've worked with them for 4 years now, and their product in my store, probably when it's off the shelf, our sales go down thousands of dollars a week. So this is like one of our huge sellers. And today I'm part owner of that company because we didn't laugh at them. We took them seriously. We basically give everybody a chance. And so I think as a producer coming into a store, look for people who are going to help you get your product to where you want it to be, or they will help you get it to where it needs to be. So we've also had people come in who don't have the quality that we're quite looking for. And again, we won't laugh at you. We won't send you away and make you feel bad. We'll tell you why and say, bring it back. We want to see it again. So don't be afraid to hear the word no. You're probably going to hear it a lot more than you think. And keep coming back, you know.
Well, folks, that's all the time we have for our first hour of the Marijuana Agenda. We had some extended segments today, but Stay tuned, because coming up next in Toker Talk Radio, I've got a radical rant on how the worst of us are going to ruin legalization for the rest of us. Plus more from the world of marijuana news coming up next. Thanks for joining us, and until next time, take care of each other, Tokers.
Follow MJ Agenda on Facebook, Pinterest, Instagram, YouTube, and follow MJ Agenda Show on Twitter. Learn more at MJAgenda.com.
You plant it, you grow it, you try it, you roll it, you smoke it. You take a seed, you plant it, you